You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith, featuring the April 2024 Opera with Opera News magazine. We'll begin by continuing Follow the Swallow, Ditlev Rindom on the original La Rondine. Puccini enriches the instrumentation for this second verse, adding a harp part that glitters like gold, and preparing for the even grander orchestration of Magda's own verse. Crucially, this addition is one of several that underlines that Prunier, rather than Ruggiero, is the real second character in La Rondine, the philosopher of the opera, as Puccini described him. Another major difference occurs in Act III, when the trio between Prunier, Lisette, and Magda has an entirely different vocal distribution to the standard version as they try to lure her back to Paris. While in the first edition, Magda tells Prunier, "You don't know how much harm you're doing me." In the original, she moreover responds savvily, "You don't know how much good you're doing me." Magda is already contemplating her exit back to the city. Magda herself, overall, emerges as a more independent figure in this original version. Her Act I aria, Ore Dolce e Divine, has 12 extra bars, as well as many small differences to the overall vocal line that build the aria more slowly towards a more sustained climax. But it is the conclusions to Acts 2 and 3 that are most dramatically significant. In the standard version, Act 2 ends with Magda singing in unison with Ruggiero as the curtain descends, lost in bliss at the new relationship. In the original, she sings alone, uncertain at the bold, possibly rash decision she has made. Similarly, there are no unison lines in the final duet of the original Rondine. Magda's departure is more defiant than tearful, the expression of a woman who realizes that her relationship with Ruggiero can only ever be fleeting. Puccini's original idea makes the modernity and independence of Magda even clearer, while strengthening a sense of dramatic unity across the work. All three acts here end with Magda singing alone, pursuing a fantasy with no need of tenorial assistance, a destiny of her own choosing. Compared to Magda and Prunier, Ruggiero can seem lightly drawn, even underdeveloped. Dramatically, this has its own logic, making Ruggiero a mere screen for Magda's desires. But it also marks an obvious difference from Bohème or Traviata, and in neither the autograph nor the first edition does Ruggiero have an entrance aria in Act I. This absence is something that Puccini changed for the second edition, adapting his wartime song Morire into the aria Parigi. But in the original Rondine, Ruggiero's scene at the beginning of Act III does include several extra lines that later became a purely orchestral postlude, a musical idea that Puccini reinserted in a revised form in the second edition, before removing it again for the third, as part of the broader amplification of Ruggiero's role. Perhaps the most striking thing that emerges from a study of Puccini's autograph is the sheer scale of revision he undertook while writing out the score. Small deletions and corrections are unsurprising in a manuscript of this size, but here one sees firsthand Puccini's uncertainty over some of the opera's most powerful moments. The Act II quartet, for example, which, like Parigi, was based on a pre-existing piece, in this case a piano work, clearly caused Puccini serious headaches. In the autograph, all of the choral and solo parts in the climactic final bars are crossed out, revealing that Puccini initially imagined this whole section finishing with an instrumental peroration. Pencil markings in the margin indicate that the voices should be reinstated. Elsewhere, inspired ideas for the chorus were allowed to stand, but were later cut for the first edition. The waltz that launches the party at Boulier has choral interjections. Viva Boulier, viva amor, in the autograph, cut for the first edition but revised and reinstated in the third edition. and the offstage voice that haunts Magda at the climax of Act Two, when she chooses to flee with Ruggero, was originally a tenor rather than a soprano. Is this voice perhaps in some way Prunier, who foretells the opera's narrative throughout Act One? Details such as these inevitably raise major questions over why and when Puccini changed his mind so emphatically about details in the work, even as he reinstated some of these ideas later on. The autograph contains a huge number of differences in the orchestration when compared with the first edition, with the autograph generally less bombastic in its use of percussion. A direct parallel with La Fanciulla del West, where the orchestration was thickened around the time of the first New York performance in collaboration with Toscanini. Perhaps this lighter orchestration reflects the opera's origins as an operetta, an approach that proved less appropriate once the work reached larger opera theaters. In many other cases, however, lines were removed between parts and the orchestration entirely reworked in ways that transform the color of individual sections. These changes are reflective of the orchestral creativity throughout the opera, filled with rapid alterations in timbre that bring the glitter of Parisian society vividly to life. While Lehar has frequently been invoked in discussions of Rondinet, French contemporaries are arguably just as relevant to an understanding of the work. Ravel, for example, had adapted his Valse Noble et Sentimentale as the ballet Adelaide in 1912, the story of a Parisian courtesan remarkably similar to Magda. And Rondinet's mixture of irony and sentiment anticipates many of the works of Poulenc, who would himself turn to Monte Carlo for the premiere of the ballet Les Biches in 1923, a work similarly focused on the leisure pursuits of the young, beautiful, and idle rich, perfect fodder for Prunier. The rediscovery of the Rondinet autograph ultimately makes it clear that Rondinet should really be understood to exist in four versions rather than three, all worthy of attention. These distinct versions bear witness to the generic challenges and opportunities the work posed for Puccini. The four iterations of Rondinet offer discrete sound worlds, dramatic resolutions, and even different genres for this familiar tale of a fallen woman. Whichever version we settle on, this inherent ambivalence is surely what gives the opera its special allure, as well as contributing to its still relatively marginal place in the Puccini canon. This pig of an opera, as Puccini once condemned it, constantly moves between different positions, treating love with ironic detachment and even relief at its demise, even as it delivers some of the most radiant, innocent love music that Puccini ever wrote. And there is something fitting in Puccini's own inability to let go of this work, one so concerned with the allure of a brief nostalgic return to the past. The composer forever wondering how the swallow might leave home and then finally return to its nest. Ditlev Rindom's new critical edition of La Rondinet will be heard at La Scala this month, April 4th through the 20th. When Ricardo Chailly conducts Irina Brooke's new staging of Puccini's opera with Mariangela Cecilia in the title role. And now Jules Verne at the Opera by Christopher Weber. For a century and a half, Jules Verne's extraordinary voyages have entertained readers of all ages. With their rattling adventure plots, their futuristic focus on science and technology, and their sometimes astonishingly accurate predictions, books such as 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Around the World in 80 Days remain global classics on screen as well as in print. Yet, how many of his admirers know that their favorite writer considered following another path entirely? In youth, he distinguished himself as a singer, and he told the English journalist R.H. Sherard, in an 1894 interview, "My friends were nearly all musicians, and at that period of my life, I was a musician myself. I understood harmony, and I think I may say that, if I had taken to a musical career, I should have had less difficulty than many in succeeding. This may be an aging man's fantasy, but it is certainly true that while training in Paris as a lawyer, his father's wish, he was close to Leo Delibes and Victor Massé, and spent most of his time scribbling plays and comedy librettos. In the early 1850s, three of these skits were set by his fellow lodger, the aspiring composer Aristide Hignard, in Offenbach's one-act opéra bouffe style. Burns' literary mentor was the eminent Michel Carré, whose credits included many of the most celebrated operas of the time, including Gounod's Faust and Bizet's Les Pêcheurs de Perles. And for good commercial reasons, Verne's first two operatic ventures appeared with Carré's name alongside his own. Le Colin Maillard, Blind Man's Buff, 1853, and Les Compagnons de la Marjolaine, Knights of the Daffodil, 1855. Both achieved performance, if without success, apparently due to Hignard's lackluster scores, at the Théâtre Lyrique. The background of these stagings can be traced to his student days, when he held the unpaid post of secretary to Edmond Sevest, the Lyrique's director. In practice, it was young Jules who ran the venue, Paris's third operatic theater, issuing contracts, arranging monthly repertoires, hiring and firing the artists, and occasionally mounting his own work as a perk. The experience provided him with a host of valuable contacts, some of whom, such as his older contemporary, Alexandre Dumas Fils, became lifelong friends. He gained hands-on knowledge of music theater production. Most important of all, he encountered the mighty Offenbach himself, who accepted Verne and Hignard's third and best piece for production at his brand-new temple of the art, the Théâtre des Bouffes Parisiens. Monsieur de Champs-Élysées, 1858, may be featherlight, with a simple plot involving a young man dressing up as a chimp in order to visit his beloved, a zoologist's daughter. Yet the text is of considerable interest, as its 1981 publication, with a substantial introduction by the leading Offenbach scholar, Robert Pourvoyer, suggests. The cast of four features a couple of characters, the scientist Van Carcass, so intent on world-changing theories that he ignores what's going on under his nose, and his clever Spanish sidekick Baptiste, who are prototypes for leading players in many of Verne's later adventures. The satire on science and society is strong. The zoologist fails to spot the youth beneath the ape's disguise, because his cynical belief that all it takes is a waistcoat to make a chimpanzee indistinguishable from a sophisticated man of the world blinds him to reality. Staged a year before the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, Verne's little opéra bouffe audaciously calls out a sinister side to the man-monkey metaphors of its time. When Van Carcass pontificates that the ape is to a servant what a black man is to a white man, his equal, except for color, Verne puts not only the arrogant scientist, but also the whole of civilized society under his microscope. And to underline the satire against monkey mask racists, the climax of Hignard's lost score was a chica, a kind of conga. Verne was no stranger to unthinking racism. Nantes, where he grew up, had been France's port for West Indian slavers. It is tempting to imagine how Verne's career might have developed had Offenbach rather than Hignard provided music for the mildly successful Monsieur de Champs-Élysées. But it was not to be. With Orphée aux Enfers, the composer moved on to promoting the ambitious full-length operettas that dominated his work after 1858, while the writer came up in parallel with the idea of the large-scale extraordinary voyages, which swiftly made the fortune of his canny publisher, Pierre-Jules Hetzel, and a comfortable living for himself. It was to be 20 years before their paths crossed again. Yet although Verne's books were materially concerned with a mixture of genuine and speculative science, they continued to reflect the popular spirit of Offenbach's satirical, skeptical, yet hugely energetic worldview. Many of the most memorable characters from Verne's early novels could have walked in directly from the stage of the Bouffe Parisien itself. With his two wooden legs and prosthetic hand, J.T. Maston, the seriously unhinged yet principled secretary of the Baltimore Gun Club in From the Earth to the Moon, is one of Verne's most outrageous takes on the American psyche, a wooden cousin to General Boom in La Grande Duchesse de Gerolstein. Paganel, the benevolent yet utterly absent-minded man of science in Captain Grant's Children, could do duty for the alchemist Popolani in Barbe Bleue. The untouchable, emotionally challenged English eccentric Phileas Fogg is accompanied in his passage around the world in 80 days by his reluctant, yet loyal and savvy, French valet Passepartout. Both are familiar comic opera types. Moving such pieces around the chessboard of Verne's often manic plots creates a heightened world, compounding molecular fusions of plausible science and fantastical opéra bouffe. Needless to say, music itself plays a significant part in the books, often manifesting itself in Verne's infamous catalogs. Such lists often function to modify our impressions of his characters. Here, for example, is one section of Captain Nemo's library on the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. "And these musicians," said I, pointing out some works of Weber, Rossini, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, Meyerbeer, Herold, Wagner, Auber, Gounod, and a number of others, scattered over a large model piano organ which occupied one of the panels of the drawing room. "These musicians," replied Captain Nemo, "are the contemporaries of Orpheus, for in the memory of the dead all chronological differences are effaced. And I am dead, Professor, as much dead as those of your friends who are sleeping 6 feet under the earth." Despite his Flying Dutchman aura and masterly need for control, Nemo's impeccable library list encourages us to feel that the mysterious captain is not quite so inhuman as he seems. Other characters are musicians. The string quartet that collectively acts as the hero of Propeller Island, with a violist, of course, as their comic butt, are positively defined by their quality repertoire of Haydn, Beethoven, and Mendelssohn. Music can also be a subject in itself, most strikingly in the dystopian vision of Paris in the 20th century. The 1860 novel, rejected point-blank by Hetzel for its dark, despairing tone and bleak conclusion. It was thought lost until 1989, when Verne's great-grandson discovered the manuscript in a rusty old family chest, which was about to be consigned to the rubbish dump. First published in 1994, the novel proved a remarkably prescient vision of a 1960s high-rise city, whose human ants are enthralled to technology, and where inane mechanical music gets pumped out by the city authorities. Literature is dead, strictly off limits for a public that has forgotten the very names of Shakespeare and Victor Hugo. As for music, one of the partisans secretly opposing the new civilization tells us that, "In the last century, a certain Richard Wagner, a sort of messiah, who has been insufficiently crucified, invented the music of the future, and we're still enduring it, on the pretext that we are following new formulas. A score now consists of only a single phrase, long, loopy, endless. At the opera, it begins at 8 o'clock and ends just before midnight. If it should extend 5 minutes more, it costs the management a fine and overtime for the house workers. Either we endure this nauseating melody of the virgin forest, insipid, confused, indeterminate, or else various harmonic rackets are produced. Beyond the pea shooter aimed at Wagner, one wonders whether our modern minimalists would recognize themselves in this. Byrne's prophetic litany continues. Although the old masterpieces are still being performed in his 1960s Paris, nobody has time for them, so the spoken dialogue in Orphée aux Enfers has been replaced with brief musical recitatives by Gounod, and Les Huguenots has been cut to a single act. The tease contains elements that seem too close for comfort. How far was Verne's interest in opera reflected by opera's interest in Verne? The stage spectaculars of his most popular novels, written in collaboration with Adolphe Denery, the P.T. Barnum of French theater, contained enough music to bring them within touching distance of modern blockbuster musicals such as Les Misérables. But French composers never raced to turn his books into operas. Doubtless, fear of litigation played its part, but the technical difficulty of adapting travelogues which relied so heavily on grand natural vistas must have been equally off-putting. When first considering an adaptation of his Siberian epic, Michael Strogoff, Verne's main question was how on earth Denery proposed to set a full pack of ravening wolves loose on stage. Somehow, he managed it plausibly enough for the show to be one of Verne's biggest hits. It was left to operatic composers across the Pyrenees to put their heads into the lion's mouth. Pourvoyeur lists 7 zarzuela versions staged in 19th century Madrid. And in fact, there were more, even if Emilio Arrieta's grandiose 3-act melodrama La Guerra Santa, 1879, avoided the wolf problem in Michael Strogoff only by leaving them howling off stage, possibly muzzling its own chances of success in the process. Far and away the most vigorous Vernian zarzuela is Manuel Fernandez Caballero's Los Sobrinos del Capitán Grant, 1877, where magnificent scenic effects, including an abduction by giant condor, are counterpointed by engaging Madrileño characters and a tongue-in-cheek, surreal humor, truer to the novel than anything in Disney's movie version, In Search of the Castaways. It also boasts a famously brilliant score featuring a habanera-style smoking chorus for the ladies of Chile, some way beyond Carmen, a bilingual duet counterpointing the stylistic differences between English and Spanish ladies in love, cannibal barbecues, and an underwater Australian ballet, which culminates in a death duel between a diver and a giant octopus. Verne's name has understandably been linked to Offenbach's Le Voyage dans la Lune, 1875. But the notion that this opéra fairy relies in any significant way on From the Earth to the Moon is as airy-fairy as its plot. The fact that the novelist considered suing Offenbach for plagiarism, only to drop the idea once he realized that the only common point was that both sets of astronauts were fired from a gigantic cannon, tells us all we need to know. Whereas Verne's travelers circle around the moon, getting close enough to see that the satellite is an airless, lifeless rock, before heading back for a splash landing off the Florida coast, Offenbach's fairy tale courtiers land there to find love in a sentimental society very like their own. All we can say is that the lunar mood was in the Parisian air. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.